down and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
the exact same spot,
05,
but I'm sorry,
like,
say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like
this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 446 of Strange Days Indeed for the end of July 2007. This time, our editorial contributor, Dave Ferlott, British correspondent Stuart Miller of UFOReview.net, and for the first time in a very long time on this program, abduction researcher Dr. David Jacobs of Temple University joins us from his home in Pennsylvania to talk about his findings as a result of working with thousands of abductees over the years. And my thanks to John Velez for setting up the interview. I forgot what I wasn't supposed to remember is an expanded view of the alien abduction phenomenon and contains details that are certain to be firsts regarding the reporting of the abduction phenomena to the public. I forgot what I wasn't supposed to remember involves experiences with several different types of alien beings, including different types of grays, hybrids, blondes, short, pudgy beings, tanned, wrinkled beings, interdimensional beings, superconscious beings, and incorporeal influences. I forgot what I wasn't supposed to remember is abductee Katarina Wilson's new book, and is the first time a first edition book about the alien abduction phenomenon has been published online and offered free to the public. It covers 12 years of consciously recalled abduction encounters that Katarina has experienced since she published her journals in the Alien Jigsaw in 1993. The pieces of the puzzle have continued to fall into place to reveal why these beings are interacting with specific people on our planet, de facto emissaries between human beings and alien beings. You can download the book for free from alienjigsaw.com, and you'll need Adobe Acrobat Reader to read it. And remember, many of the topics discussed here, if not all, on SDI, can be read in depth at the UFO Updates Archive at virtuallystrange.net.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Ferlott.
On July 13, 2007, Larry King Live did a show called Are UFOs Real? And for those of you that did not get to see the show, the transcript of the show is posted on the UFO Updates list. The transcript of the show just made me shake my head because some of the things that were said need to be read to be thoroughly understood. In the show, he addressed several different UFO cases with notable witnesses from each of them. With Roswell, he had Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman, and Julie Schuster, daughter of Walter Hout. After a little discussion about Roswell, Larry King added Michael Shermer of Skeptic Magazine and James Fox, executive producer of the UFO documentary Out of the Blue. He also included George Norrie from the radio show Coast to Coast and the ex-astronaut Buzz Aldrin. Finally, he includes the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, to discuss the 1997 sighting of a large, slow-moving craft that he saw, even though he initially stated there was no UFO sighting or UFOs involved in the Phoenix Lights incident. Now, although many people watch the show, I find it uncanny that nobody picked up many of the things that were said about several of the cases by some of the participants and actually ran with them. Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. stated emphatically that his father, Major Jesse Marcel, did not mistakenly identify a weather balloon or a Mogul balloon as a flying saucer. He also verified that what he personally saw was not balsa wood with some kind of pretty printed paper glued to it. Julie Schuster then affirmed some of the items named in the sworn affidavit that her father made just before his death. But she also made mention that her father was very strong on his statement that what was recovered by the 509th at Roswell Army Air Force Base was not of this earth. The only real rebuttal of the testimony came from the USAF, stating that people had seen recovery procedures used for parachute dummies in the 50s near Roswell, New Mexico. The show overall seemed to have followed that formula for each segment. Some very compelling testimony brought forward and some extremely lame explanation brought out in rebuttal. It boggles my mind how anyone can dismiss some of the things said on the program as being nothing more than ramblings of kooks, crackpots, or saucer heads. But then, of course, you have Michael Shermer, Skeptic Magazine, a magazine created by CSI, formerly known as PsyCop. He's a man who takes the line that there are no such thing as UFOs or aliens and will proclaim loudly to anyone that all those things simply don't exist. The problem with that is, unless you believe that people like Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, Buzz Aldrin, the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, and thousands of other people who say they've seen craft in the sky that exhibit tendencies that our current technology cannot duplicate are telling us lies, there is something out there. But I digress. Back to the show. Statements were made on Larry King Live that need to be examined deeper. You have someone that has seen the debris from the Foster Ranch firsthand, has handled that debris, telling us exactly what he saw and handled, yet we have someone who wasn't even born at the time saying, no, sorry, what you saw and handled was nothing more than balsa wood with paper tape on it and some foil-covered rubber. What? We're expected to believe the idiot that proclaims he knows better then the person who handled the stuff knows what it is? Then you have a sworn affidavit that, for all intent and purpose, can be construed as a deathbed confession telling us that what was recovered was not from this world. Okay, let me repeat that. Not from this world. That's pretty black and white to me. If it's not from this world, then it's from some other world, meaning from some other planet. And it had to get here somehow. Now, was everyone on Larry King's show just a crackpot, kook, liar, or saucerhead? Michael Shermer would like us to believe that they are. But sorry, there is no evidence to prove that they are not telling us the truth. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Good take, Dave. And you laid it out the way it is.
That's the part that drives me insane. How can anybody turn to Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. and say, no, sorry, that wasn't what it was. Here's what you saw. Here's what you handled. Here's what you looked at. Here's what you felt. What? Give me a break. Unless the learned doctor is really lying out of his teeth to us for whatever ungodly known reason, there's no way. I'm going to believe the guy that actually handled it.
And that whole thing about bringing in a skeptic to balance things, And as somebody said on the updates list, Stan Friedman looked as if he were about to slam his head on the desk several times. The whole distraction of Michael Shermer being there, and not only Shermer being there, but him bringing the cute little aliens in and plunking them down on the desk.
Yeah.
That they come out of the commercial break and tight in on the little green aliens and pull back. And Shermer constantly interrupting.
Oh, yeah. His whole thing was, no, sorry. I don't believe it.
And the footage they kept running of the parachute, and the footage they kept running in the background of the parachute test dummies that happened several years after Roswell. What are these people thinking at CNN? And not a mention of the footage as to what it was.
No, just letting that run and trying to let people sort of, oh, okay, so that's what they saw. No, that's not it at all, guys. Parachute test dummies in the 50s do not, by any stretch of the imagination, can be construed as anything else. Nobody is going to mistakenly identify a parachute test dummy as a live, breathing, or dead creature. It's so asinine, it's just amazing.
And the descriptions of the creature that have come out in Carrie and Schmidt's book, the subsequent witnesses who have come forward, either in first person, for example, MPs who were actually there, or the descendants, the relatives, the kids of witnesses, and all of those statements that...
Yeah, first off, they're talking very much in depth about these creatures and what they looked like, and somehow these are just some kind of dummy. Give me a break.
Yeah, well, we're all dummies, too.
Well, we're dummies because the good old USAF turns around and believes that we should buy into this because they're telling us what it is.
I don't understand the inclusion of Shermer at all. Get the story out, and then you can have all the debunkers and all the skeptics on another program and let them have their say.
Yeah, let them take their shots at it. And especially with some of these observers, some of the people that look at this stuff are very familiar with stuff that's up in the air that should be there. So when they look up and they see something that shouldn't be there, don't try and tell them that they're mistaken.
Oh, you mean like Buzz Aldrin?
Like...
Who was also on Larry King Live that night.
Oh, yeah. We have to go one way or the other with him because he tends to get a little confused at times.
Yeah, he flip-flops on what it was that they saw on their way to the moon. On the one hand, he says, yeah, well, that panel was 2,000 miles away, according to ground control.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
And what they saw was not 2,000 miles away. It was more like 20 feet away.
Yeah.
I'm sure there'll be many more Larry King-type programs with debunkers on them. You and I both know what it is that CSI, what an original name, that the former PSYCOP...
took out the scientific investigation.
Well, they never had it in there in the first place.
Well, not the
real thing, anyway.
No, but remember Joe Dickel. Scientific investigation is our middle name.
Oh, please. The former mouthpiece for PSYCOP, now Michael Shermer, because he's younger, much more glib, and much better looking than Joe Dickel. So we'll have him on instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank God we're not television, eh?
Oh, good Lord.
Dave, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we shall talk again soon.
For sure.
Bye-bye. One of my favorite segments on a regular basis on this program is when we cross the pond and we run into Stuart Miller, who's sort of somewhere out there in the middle. He's in Cheshire, just outside Manchester, Corrie country, for those of you who understand the word Corrie. And he is live on the line with us. Good day, Stuart.
Good day. I have a mug full of bile today.
Oh, my.
And general unpleasantness.
Oh. Well, I look forward to hearing it.
Whinging and moaning and whining and complaining about this and about that. And
let's start off with this.
Okay, well, this relates to something that Jerry Clark has now named Germanism or Germanism. Earlier in the week, I was exceptionally rude about Jerry Clark and Dick Hall on my website.
Quite so I understand, yes.
Oh, words got back, is it?
Oh, yes.
Good. Well, there's another piece there now I just filled in today, indirectly relating to them. I'll get to that here for you. I must, in all fairness, redress the balance ever so marginally and slightly, and just acknowledge in the direction of Mr. Clark a very, very valid point I thought he made in a posting. In essence, and I'm not quoting verbatim, he alleged that there were lots of people, like me, jumping all over his back about the way he treated Mr. German. That nobody was criticizing Ed for his equally staunch negative criticism and observation of, for example, the ETH. I actually think that is a very valid point. Ed has been completely offhand and very close-minded. He's been rude himself about any other theory other than his.
The extraterrestrial hypothesis.
No, Ed's theory is the fact that we share this planet with, I think he calls them monotremes, other cuddly folk. They might be humans or humanoid, and they're responsible for UFOs, and they've developed their own technology and learnt to fly in space. He has constructed this... He's constructed this theory on the basis of the AA film. That's Ed's theory, and Ed's sticking to it, and the ETH is absolute rubbish, and there's no proof or shred of evidence to suggest that that's got any validity whatsoever. And I do want to redress the balance ever so marginally and say I think that Jerry Clark's got a point. But Jerry Clark has criticized people like myself for the fact that he's rejected Ed's theory or philosophy out of hand. It's not that. It's not the fact that he and Dick Hall have rejected the theory out of hand. It is their rudeness. That's what it is. And that's really probably why Ed has got away with it, because, okay, I did allege a moment ago he'd been rude, and he'd been a bit blunt, but he's not been rude in the way that Jerry Clark and Dick Hall have been about Ed, and that's really what it is. That's what's got people's goats up. And that's certainly what's got my goat up.
Would I be remiss as the moderator in allowing all of those rude posts to appear on the list?
No, not at all. You'd have been remiss for not posting them. They're entitled to their opinion. It's just I think they've expressed them, and obviously a lot of people share this opinion. They've expressed them rather rudely. And the point I made in my rather rude and insulting comments about Dick and Jerry is, and this has come up before, this is the problem, this is a repeat. We've been here before with this scenario. They stand like guardians. I called it at the gate of extraterrestrialdom, only allowing through those theories that they approve of, and anything else is rejected out of hand. I agree with them, really, at the criticism of Ed's ideas and his philosophy. Let's face it, Ed is bonkers, and it doesn't really make much sense or stand up to much what he's alleging. There's not a shred of proof, and okay, I mean, the one point I would concede in Ed's direction is that you really cannot make an absolute statement about what may or may not have been on planet Earth, previous civilizations, or even parallel with us now. You can't make an absolute statement that there's been no weirdness beforehand. Well, that's about the only thing I think you can say in favor of Ed's argument.
Is there anything that you'd like to say to Ed directly, because he does listen to this program?
Hello, Ed. No, not really, other than the fact that I respect his right to express his opinion, and certainly people are entitled to criticize his opinion. I think the issue here has been the rudeness with which Jerry Clark and Dick Hall have done that, that I've certainly taken issue with.
I guess Dick Hall can be forgiven for being aging and cantankerous and having seen and heard all of this stuff before. Unfortunately, as has been pointed out to me, both Jerome Clark and Richard Hall are behaving in the same way that they decry the debunker crowd.
Yep.
That's unfortunate.
I would disagree with one thing you said there, which is that Dick Hall can be excused for being cantankerous, basically because of old age. No, he can't.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I'm not saying that you're anywhere near his age. You're not elderly, Errol. You're not elderly.
No.
But you're older than me. You're not cantankerous, are you? You know, in the way that Dick is.
Well, you could talk to my cats about that.
Well, yes, but that's why they're there. You vent on your cat, don't you? Not human beings.
Well, exactly. And yes, you're right. There really is no excuse for either of them behaving that way. And unfortunately, it really doesn't help them with their complaints against the likes of Ed Gurman.
Yep. Now, on the subject of Dick Hall, I'm going to be very nasty again. Dick is one of the leading advocates, if not, and Jerry Clark is as well, about how the only way, really, you can approach the subject of UFOs, and that is via the scientific method. Science is the only answer to getting to the bottom of the subject of UFOs and what they are and possibly explaining them. And only if only we could get the right scientists to look at the subject, then all would be well with everything forever.
Mm-hmm.
NARCAP finally got around to publishing their report on the O'Hare sighting of last November. And they published a file that, even with my high-speed connection, took so long to download that it was monstrous in size.
152 pages.
Yes. And at the end of it, what did they conclude?
They didn't know what it was.
It was a thing.
Exactly.
So the best scientific brains available to ufology have spent 9 months looking at this and produced an enormous report and have concluded absolutely nothing, which is exactly what science will do unless they're looking at natural phenomena.
Yeah.
I'm talking about generally, not in relation to O'Hare. When it comes to anything that's not natural phenomena, science draws a blank. So you've then got to ask yourself, well, what is the point?
The point is, as are most of the NARCAP investigations, they come to really no conclusion except that they can't explain it. If science became involved and came to the same conclusions, then it would justify a government funding the investigation so that any pilot, any military, any policeman, anybody could report to a central reporting agency, any military included there, without any fear of reprisal, and it would be seriously looked into, with some serious money being put into it.
I've got a quibble there. I don't think pilots are in any fear whatsoever anymore now in 2007 of reporting a UFO. And you've got the recent case, okay, he's not North American, he's a Brit, but you've got the recent case of Captain Boyer in the Channel Islands. And look at the hue and cry that was made about that. And positive hue and cry, no comeback on him at all.
But the airline whose terminal that UFO hovered over back in November of last year at Chicago's O'Hare International squelched any public release of witness UFO information. And if the pilots who had seen these things and the pilots who hung their cell phones out of their cockpit windows on the ground and shot images hadn't been told not to talk about it and hadn't been told not to release pictures, we would have had a whole bunch of witness testimony and no doubt pictures.
Well, firstly, wasn't it that actor who allegedly jumped on the thing and bought the rights up to it or something, you know, because suddenly it all went very quiet. And that wasn't entirely down to the airline authorities.
Dan Aykroyd.
But, exactly, yes.
But if you recall, if you'd listened to the Chicago Tribune reporter.
I read the article.
And subsequent interviews, including one that I did with him, he said that the airline had come down on its employees and said, don't talk about this.
Right, okay. And in 2006/2007, why do you think an airline would do that? Because I can assure you of one thing, Errol, and I mean, I can't promise you this as verbatim fact, but I feel very strongly about this. The one thing it isn't is ridicule. Or the one thing it isn't is fear of putting passengers off from flying with the airline. I bet you it's got nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Probably the only justifiable reason is, well, we don't want to scare our passengers, you know.
No, I bet you it's not that. I bet you they know something. And if they know something, then...
And if there were an official investigation into UFOs, then that clampdown wouldn't be put on those employees, is my point.
I'm sorry, but I think you've let NARCAP off the hook, and I don't mean this in a critical sense towards them, but I mean from what I read, what I could see from the report, they did a damn thorough job.
Yes.
You know, and I'm not sure what external scientific input that could have been further brought. I mean, I'm sure they were limited in some ways by what they could do, but, you know, I'm not sure what bringing in some other individual or group could have done to enhance the conclusion of that report. Yeah. And my point being, with all the care and with all the detail that NARCAP took, 10 months later, all they could do on the basis of their approach was to say, well, we don't know what it was. It was something solid. They presumed that.
Well, it had to be. I mean, anything that punches a hole in the cloud and that hole stays there, the diameter of the object, and that stays there for 20 minutes where you can see blue sky through the cloud, it ain't anything that we can create here.
I don't know. You see, that's my suspicion that it is. But, of course, it's only a suspicion. That is my thinking. Although, why the hell it would be messing about over a commercial airport, I don't know.
Where are the potentially professional witnesses? There are a lot of witnesses looking up in the sky, watching what's going on in the sky. Where are there witnesses who understand aviation? Other than Chicago O'Hare International, the second biggest airport in the world.
All good questions, all good points, but let's take it to the sort of area that we would like and then ask a logical question there. Why would something not of this planet come and fly around O'Hare Airport?
Simply because of the witnessing potential?
Oh, so it was there, like, showing itself off?
Yes.
With the Phoenix Lights job.
Look at us. We're hanging out over one of the major airports in the world. And now watch what we do when we leave. Now we've got your attention.
Well, you might be right. I think it's a very, very puzzling case.
Oh, yeah.
I really, really have no idea what it is. And no real instinct other than the fact that I just somehow feel it might be terrestrial-based.
What gives you that feeling, Stuart?
I don't know, Errol. I'm not convinced that what I've said is right. I feel it might be, but it's very much might and maybe as opposed to, oh, it's definitely. I have another gripe. I think that these last few days, the UFO community, such as it is, has played right into the hands of skeptics. And I am thinking about the news headline that you cannot fail to have seen, which was along the lines of, sighting brings whole town to standstill.
Ah, yes.
And this was about the, quote, Armada that flew over Stratford-on-Avon.
In the UK, yes.
In the UK, yes. But it was everywhere, all over the internet. Now, that story must have run the course for a good week. People are still chundering on about it now. At the time the story broke, a rugby club... Rugby is the game upon which football is based. And a rugby club held their hands up and said, it's a bunch of escape lanterns that escaped from our ground. And everybody ignored them. They gave the story a good run and then came round in full circle. And somebody said, oh, it's actually, after all that, it's a bunch of lanterns. What a complete waste of time.
That's the media, and that's one or two investigator researchers.
No, we're not going to blame the media. I mean, we can blame them partly, but the media only did... They only did what they would normally have done. They gave it a run. It was the people, like me, that reported the story.
And me.
Well, yes. No, but the fact is... People kept reporting the story. That's the point. It just went on and on and on. And really, this one should have died at birth.
Yeah. I don't recall seeing yet an explanation for that come across my screen.
Lanterns.
Well, I didn't see that explanation come across my screen. Nobody picked up on it and said, hey, I got to send this to UFO Updates.
Sorry.
That would have killed the story as far as the UFO community was concerned right there.
I'm sorry, Errol. I've been remiss in my duties in not sending
you. Oh, it's okay. I know you're a very busy man, Stuart.
But yes, it was lanterns, but then we were told it was lanterns right from the start, and so you've just got to wonder why we've wasted our time. The demise of the weekly world news seems to have...
A tragedy. A tragedy.
Well, yes, it is, because it was a lot of fun. I rarely saw a copy, because I don't think it was... I think it was published in the UK at one point, but not successfully. it played its part and was part of the, if I dare to use this word, the culture for a long, long time. And yet, I think a lot of people are just pleased to see it go.
Yeah, somebody sent me a lovely picture of George Bush looking at, I think it was the last issue of the Weekly World News, George W. standing in an aircraft holding an open copy of Weekly World News and Aliens Back Bush.
Yes, but they had a few like that. They did mock up some very good pictures. There's a story that's just erupted over the last couple of days, and I just want to state clearly, I'm about to say something in which I completely and totally agree with Alfred Lemberg, because I've read Alfred's comments on this. There's a gentleman with a blog called UFOmagazine.net, and Bill Burns has descended upon him with a cease and desist lawyer's letter. The way the story is broken, actually, is that Bill Burns is claiming that UFO Magazine own or have trademarked the word UFO, and that you can't use the word UFO because Bill Burns has trademarked it. And all the public sympathy has obviously gone to this poor chap whose name is Mike Coletta, who owns this blog, because of course it's the big bad corporation descending upon this poor little guy. Like Alfred, I completely and totally agree with what Bill Burns has done. I think he's been perfectly reasonable, and it makes perfect sense. It's not actually the fact that UFO Magazine have trademarked the word UFO. It is the fact that this guy calls his blog UFOmagazine.net. In other words, it's as if he's passing off his blog as being owned by UFO Magazine, and there is no connection whatsoever. And I think Alfred's comments on the site were to do with the fact that he turned up on that site for the very first time. And the site's been there a while now, maybe a couple of months or so, thinking it was something to do with UFO Magazine, only to find when he got there it wasn't. And I, the same. So what I'm saying is, although public sympathy might appear at this moment in time to be with Mr. Coletta, in truth, right is indeed on the side of Mr. Burns. And I hope Mr. Burns squashes this guy into the dirt and kicks him out.
Well, I've been to that site, and as far as I'm concerned, the word UFO cannot be trademarked. But when you put the words UFO and magazine together, then you are trespassing on somebody else's property.
Yep.
From what I can see, his site does nothing to help the UFO field at all, has very little to do with UFOs, and is merely a publicity ploy to get people to listen to his podcast, which also have nothing to do with UFOs. They're paranormal. And having run through the list of programs that he's got listed there, I don't see any UFO programs. So he's just found a way that he can probably generate a lot of publicity. And he's in the wrong. Absolutely no doubt about it. And any court would just dump all over this man. And I think Burns, taking the tack, we've copyrighted, we've trademarked the word UFO. No, you trademarked UFO Magazine. Common yeah. knowledge is UFO Magazine is run by the Burns, formerly by the Eckers. And it doesn't matter who the parent company is. UFO Magazine is UFO Magazine, and it's not this Coletta at all. And he has absolutely no right or any moral ground to stand on.
So we're both against him, and we're both behind Mr. Burns.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Does it feel uncomfortable?
No, not at all. No, 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 no. Being on the same side as the Burns is and UFO Magazine does not make me feel uncomfortable at all.
Okay, well, moving on, seems that the UK suffered a slight downturn in the number of sighting reports in the year 2006. In 2005, we had 150 or just over 150, and in 2006, we had something over 100. So we potentially have lost close to maybe a third.
Is that because there are diminishing numbers of places in the UK where UFOs can be reported? Or is that actually people wandering around the streets paved with gold, looking for loose bits of gold and not looking at the sky?
I think it's probably the latter. I can't remember where I read this. It might have been on some blog, but there was some guy predicting that with the advent of camera phones, the number of UFO sightings would plummet. He was absolutely adamant about it.
What's the logic behind that statement?
I can't remember. I was equally disgusted by a report by the National Academies, and Paul Scott Anderson, he of Crop Circle fame, made mention and reference to it on UFO Updates. NASA, through or via the National Academies, published a report called Life Elsewhere in the Solar System Could Be Different from Life as We Know It. And when I looked at their conclusions, which essentially were life elsewhere in the solar system could be different from life as we know it. That, I mean, the title really just about summed it up. We should be vigilant and not expect to find life with a head, two hands, and two legs, or necessarily water-based.
And I wonder how many hundreds of thousands of dollars they spent on that
exactly.
study.
Now, I just couldn't believe it. I just wondered what was going on. Even somebody just only moderately interested in the subject of extraterrestrial life would have enough now to know that you take it as you find it. It could be anything. It could be here now, and we just don't recognize it. It's a very strong possibility.
I would say that all the groundwork has been done over the last 50 or 60 years by the science fiction writers.
Absolutely, yeah. Good point, actually. On Friday, all being well, and the weather not letting anybody down, there's going to be a very exciting event, or the start of a really exciting journey, namely the launch of the Mars Phoenix lander. It's going to take 10 months to get there. I understand the journey now between Mars and planet Earth is 100 million miles. It's going to be next May before it arrives. It is equipped with such an array of equipment, basically a couple of mini laboratories on board, that all being well, it completes the journey safely, it lands safely, and everything works when it gets there. It is probably, and I must use and insert the word probably, but it is probably going to tell us for sure whether life does exist on Mars or not. It's going to be able to dig up soil off the Martian surface and analyze it on board and then send the results back to Earth. And on the basis of its analysis, scientists will... They're not claiming... It's very political. They're very neatly sidestepping the phrase or the phraseology that title, or indeed the claim that it's going to confirm life is there. But it's all about doing that. And I wish it the best, and I wish it success.
Me too.
It's going to be very important.
Whose craft is it?
It is NASA's, but the science experiments that it's going to be carrying out and the administration of those experiments is being done by the University of Arizona. And if, in fact, there's a major Canadian input as well, a very important part, and indeed the Brits have as well. Considering the significance of this, it is interesting that NASA are really just responsible for getting the thing there, and pretty much everything else is the responsibility of the University of Arizona. But come next May, assuming the craft gets there safely, it could be very exciting.
And in view of the study that NASA has just released, suggesting that life elsewhere could be very different from life as we know it here, who knows what they know already?
That's it, Errol. I've all spleened out. Venom.
Yeah, venom and very attractive bile.
Good.
Thank you, Stuart Miller.
It's a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure, and look forward to talking with you soon.
All the best, Errol.
All the best to you, Stuart. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I woke up in my room late one night to a light that was way too bright. I looked around and screamed in fright when I beheld a dear sight. Three little gray things looked at me as I began to flow. Silently I tried to move and call for help. Paralyzed, I couldn't even yelp. Alien abduction, like gravity and fluxion, loaded me to their ship sail. When they asked me for an introduction, told her my name was Roswell. I could hear the telepathic screams.
Our featured guest is Associate Professor of History at Temple University, specializing in 20th century American history and culture. He began researching the controversy over unidentified flying objects in the United States in the mid-1960s and has amassed over 35 years of primary research data and analytical hypothesis on the subject. Since 1973, he's continued to devote most of his professional and personal energies to researching the UFO phenomena in general and abduction phenomenon in particular. And having conducted over 750 hypnotic regressions with over 125 abductees, he's one of the foremost UFO abduction researchers worldwide. And as a result of his extensive primary research, he's developed the first scientific typology of the abduction experience. He's written and delivered many articles, papers, and addresses on the subject of UFO abduction, and has been a consultant to the major UFO organizations. In 1992, Dr. Jacobs' second book, Secret Life, First-Hand Accounts of UFO Abductions, was published by Simon & Schuster. And that book is the most complete exposition of the structure and meaning of the abduction phenomenon yet published. His latest book, The Threat, was published by Simon & Schuster in January 1998. Boy, David Jacobs, that all sounds so long ago, doesn't it?
Well, actually, there's another book that came out in the year 2000 and edited the book published by the University Press of Kansas.
Of course, yes.
And I'm up to over 1,000 regressions, and I've investigated more than 1,100 abduction events and so forth. Since The Threat came out, we've continued to do our research, and things are falling into place a little bit more. It's a wild and woolly subject, I will say that.
It certainly appears to be, and when you talk to abductees, there's no doubt about it. It's a wild and woolly subject. And obviously, since what I just read, there has been much time passed. Have you come to any further conclusions, or have you changed your mind about anything?
Well, what I'm struck by is the fact that I'm pleased that I was as accurate as I was in The Threat. I suggested in The Threat that this was a program, that it wasn't an experiment or a study. I suggested that it was for ultimately an integration into the society. And I think I stumbled into being correct.
And how does that make you feel?
Well, I got an email today from someone saying that he's been a friend of mine for years, but he's wavering about whether this is good or not good. He tended to think that maybe it wasn't so good. Now he's tending to think that it's a lot better because we don't really know alien minds and we don't know what they have in store for us. I tend to disagree with him. I think that we pretty much do know what's in store. And the alien mind is indeed alien, but it is not so alien that it cannot be understood.
There's a couple of statements. We do know what is in store for us.
Well, there's limits to how much we know, but we can see the outlines, and we can't really go beyond what we know, but we know quite a bit now. And what I said in The Threat, this appears to be coming about, and there are certain things we don't know, and maybe we won't know until much later, or maybe we can't ever know. I'm not sure of that. One of the things we don't know is why the whole thing is happening. We know what is happening, and we know sort of immediate goals, but we don't understand the huge why of why are they here and why are they doing whatever they are doing. That is the ultimate question of abduction research, and that we don't know. At that point, you begin to fill in details about what we don't know, but in sort of broad strokes, we do know. Now, when I say no, when I talk about knowledge, you have to remember my standard disclaimer that I just have to make every time I speak about this subject. We are dealing with, quote, evidence, end quote, that is derived from human memory with all its problems. And speaking as a person who's almost 65, I understand the problems of memory. Personally, that memory is derived from hypnosis, with all its problems, usually administered by amateurs who don't know what they're doing. Like me, for instance. So consequently, we are dealing with a level of knowledge that is low indeed in terms of its verifiability, in terms of its credibility, in terms of everything. And we all have to keep that in mind. Now, having said that, of course, it is also important to say that we have a tremendous amount of it, and that it is evidence regardless of how low on the totem pole it is, and that it adds up to a concrete, precisely detailed stream of information that conforms to the idea of reality rather than fantasy. In other words, if this were fantasy, if this were something that were being made up for whatever reason, it does not matter what the reason is. It is therefore psychological. And we would be getting, without question, a wide variety of accounts, oftentimes based on a person's culture and life and upbringing and all that. And they would all have a certain sort of psychological story that they want to tell us, and we'd be all over the place. And I would have dropped out of this subject many, many years ago, and I would have gone on to have a normal life. But it never did that. And when we see stories, abduction accounts that are all over the place, invariably there's a problem with the memory retrieval process. In other words, the person who's doing the hypnosis doesn't know what he's doing, or is doing it with some sort of transformational or new age agenda or something like that. Or, and here is what is even more common these days, a person simply remembers things consciously. We have learned through hard experience that remembering consciously events that happened in the abduction phenomenon is, well, let's put it this way, memories are notoriously inaccurate. And so people say, oh, well, the person remembered this without hypnosis, therefore it's more valid. And the answer is, perhaps, but experience has told us that it's probably less valid. And so every once in a while somebody will be valid, but experience has told us that when people remember things consciously, they remember bits and pieces, they remember distorted aspects of it, they remember things that didn't quite happen, they remember all sorts of things that don't add up, and then they put it together into a concrete story. And they say, this is what happened to me, I remember it. And they give me what story it is that they remember. And my answer always is, well, let's not get too fixed into concrete memories. Let's not get too invested in them. And let's see what happens with hypnosis. Oftentimes the story is stranger, and indeed that is the case. What happens is, with competent hypnosis, and with an adequate amount of skepticism, and with careful question, people will say to me, when they start to relate their story, that they're not remembering it the way that they had always remembered it, that it's different. They're not saying it's wrong. They just understand that this is different, and then they understand right away that their conscious memories were wrong, and they will just plain say that, this is not what I remembered. But this is what actually did happen, and what happened was what they remembered under hypnosis, and they're real clear about that.
Is there a common thread in all of the memories of the abductees?
Well, yes, they all remember being abducted by beings and taken on board an object, or sometimes not taken on board an object, and being under control of them, and having to do this, that, and the other thing, and having this, that, and the other thing done to them. When you're dealing with the human mind, really the sky's the limit. You can imagine anybody and or anything doing absolutely anything. But in fact, all of the stories fall within very narrow patterns. And the patterns are, once again, are not impinged upon by culture or upbringing or anything like that. They all basically remember the same thing. And if somebody remembers something that I've never heard before, well, that's off the wall, it's put on a back burner waiting for verification from others. In other words, people will say things that are not true all the time. you got to be very, very, very careful. And you have to be careful not to accept things that you think are right and reject things that you think are wrong, which is why you put it on the back burner waiting for confirmation from others. Even then, you have to be very careful about leading people, and people are vulnerable sometimes, although 90% of the time they're not suggestible. It's sort of not what people think it is. In other words, when a person does hypnosis in a competent way and doesn't have an agenda and knows what questions to ask and knows how to ask purposely misleading questions and knows how to have techniques that will test for truthfulness, when you have an agenda-free person like that doing hypnosis, the stories pretty much all conform to what actually happened to the person.
You had said that most of the hypnosis was being conducted by amateurs like yourself.
Yeah, it's a fake statement. There are no professionals in this area.
The question that I was leading to was, have you taken any of the abductees to a professional hypnotist, having worked with them yourself already, and had the professional hypnotist verify the information that you got in the first place?
Yeah, you'd think that that would be something that would be of value. The way it works, however, is that professional hypnotists have absolutely no idea how to do this kind of work. Because they don't know anything about the abduction phenomenon. And professional hypnotists primarily do three things. This is guys who have businesses. They stop stress, they stop smoking, they stop weight gain. That's their bread and butter of their business. Forensic hypnotists, clinical hypnotists, try to stop stress, stop pain, and sometimes, if they're working with PTSD patients, we'll try to get the person to remember what happened to them and that they have repressed in terms of seeing something horrible or doing something horrible in wartime or whatever it is, and try to relieve the anxiety by getting it into normal consciousness and dealing with it that way. Dealing with abductions is just, it's off the wall. That is something that hypnotists simply don't know anything about at all. I have on my computer now a 250-page manuscript on how to do hypnosis with abductees aimed at the therapeutic community. Whether I can ever get this thing published or not is very iffy. Probably not. I'll have to probably self-publish it, and it's almost ready to go. But I consult with therapists and with hypnotists across the country, trying to get them not to learn how to do hypnosis, but to learn about the abduction phenomenon so that when they hear things, they know what they're listening to and they know what questions to ask in response. Most hypnotists are totally clueless. They come to me asking for advice, or else they just send people to me. When you get people to stop smoking, that doesn't mean that you're going to find out about the abduction phenomenon, which is enormously complicated and very difficult to get at. And you'd think that would be the route that people would go to, but in fact, a regular hypnotist don't have any claimed expertise in the subject. Now, having said that, I've had people sit in on sessions with me who are therapists but who do hypnosis. They have had no problems with my work and with my hypnosis and all the rest of that stuff. And, of course, I have also worked with people who are themselves psychiatrists and psychologists and medical doctors who might have had courses in hypnosis in their training, who are themselves abductees, and I'm working with them as abductees.
Have you had instances of therapists, hypnotists coming to you saying, hey, I was working with this person and this abduction phenomena came up in the course of my work with them?
Yes, that happens all the time, actually. The standard route is a person will come to a therapist and be with that therapist for a couple of years. And the therapist knows that Steve is a normal guy. Yes, he's got pressures at work. Yes, he's got pressures at home. Yes, he's got hidden pressures inside his brain, whatever it is. But it's all well within a sort of normal situation. And he knows that the person that Steve is doesn't have a pathological problem. There's no pathology there. He knows that the person doesn't have some sort of really bizarre personality disorder, for example. He knows that the person can tell the difference between left and right, right and wrong, and fantasy and reality. And there's never been the slightest indication that he can't. And then Steve will say after a couple of years, you know, Doc, I never told you this, but, and out comes this abduction account, which throws the therapist. because they know that what the person is saying is completely insane. And yet, they know also that the person is not completely insane, because if you think you've been abducted by denizens of another world or whatever it is, that means automatically that you have serious thought process problems. You can't tell the difference between dreams and reality. You can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality. And that's going to show up in all sorts of areas of your life. It's not going to be a one-shot thing that happened to a person. Let's just say, this happened to me 10 years ago, and this is what happened, blah, blah, blah. That's not the way it works. And they're just thrown. The therapist just doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. They just immediately hit a brick wall. Then they send them to me, if they know about me, or to my colleague Bud Hopkins or somebody like that, because they don't know how to proceed.
Yeah, well, that's understandable, I guess. But do those therapists, hypnotists, do they follow up with you afterward and become intrigued by what they've come across?
No, they would rather palm them off on me. The ones that I've worked with and sent material to and all the rest of this stuff almost never follow up. It's an extremely difficult situation. It takes a lot of time. Most of the people who are therapists are professionals. They're in it for money, in essence. They're paid professionals. They charge $125 an hour or whatever it is. They know that if a hypnosis takes 3 hours, let's just say, they're going to have to bill the person $375, and the person's never going to come back again. And, you know, there's all sorts of problems that are in the way of that. I've been extremely fortunate in that as a professor, I have taken the time outside of my classes and committee work and so forth to be able to set days aside and do this kind of work. And of course, I do it for free, and that's just not going to happen with normal therapists. There's a sacrifice that you have to make in terms of time and money when you do this work, and most professionals just aren't going to make that sacrifice, because deep down inside of them, they know for an absolute fact that you can't be abducted. That's just crazy, period.
And we'll come back to abductions again, but since you brought it up, your professorship at Temple, your colleagues presumably are very aware of what it is that you do there.
Exquisitely aware. I must say that the amount of support that I've had from the department has been just exactly what I thought, which is zero. And I've been doing this for a long time, and now we have a whole bunch of new people. We hired a whole bunch of new faculty members recently, and the complexion of the department has changed considerably, and I am under not just scrutiny, but even a certain amount of assault recently, because they don't understand what I'm doing, and they don't want to understand. All they know is that it's totally crazy.
The John Mack syndrome.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's true. Mac just didn't fully understand the amount of anger that something like this can bring up in faculty members, and he was put under a lot of pressure. And one of the problems, of course, was that John was the psychiatrist, and when private consultation, he charged and all the rest of that stuff, and there was the insurance problems. It was a different kind of situation than what I've got. But I have paid the price at Temple. And I have paid a larger price than John ever paid, that's for sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah. John was full professor, making a tremendous salary, and having started very late, so he was able to have his career. And I started early, and therefore I wasn't able to have my career. And consequently, I'm still an associate professor. Assistant professor means without tenure. Associate professor means with tenure. Full professor means with national reputation. And I will never be full professor. Never ever going to happen, and that means that my salary is basically frozen at this mid-level, and it will never increase no matter how much I publish and how much I teach and all that.
Well, that's really disappointing, but not surprising.
Not surprising. I went in eyes open. I knew that this was a career killer, and I was right.
Yeah. Boy, there are times when you hate being right, too.
Exactly.
Have you experienced, and to go back to the title of your book, The Threat, have you experienced threats yourself because of your work?
I have. This is an area that I'm going to be very coy about, because
okay.
I've got several books inside my demented brain. One is almost finished, this hypnosis thing. The second one I've just started working on a proposal for. And then I've got a third one down the line. which will deal with that subject and the consequences of that subject. And if I'm going to write a whole book on it, you can just sort of imagine.
Yes, I was about to say, then the answer to that question is yes, and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it is yes, and right now I prefer to leave it at that. I've never been frightened about this subject before in my life, but starting in February or March or something like that of 2006, a series of events began that radically changed my life and my outlook and all sorts of things that I will be glad to talk about a little bit later. But things are different now. Things are different. I've been researching this subject since the mid-1960s. And when you said since 73, I've been still working with it. But, of course, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the subject, too, beforehand. And never been a particle of concern in my life ever. Not ever. Until last year.
Oh.
And then last year, things changed very drastically. And it'll be an interesting book, I will guarantee you that.
And I'm really tempted to ask if that was an earthly threat or from elsewhere.
Oh, no, that was from elsewhere. This was not government.
Okay.
No.
Because there was a lot of wondering about where Dr. David Jacobs had gone for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
He had been very quiet, and there was a suggestion that somehow somebody had gotten to you.
And if somebody gets to me and wants to press a check into my hand, that would be just fine. But
yes.
No, nobody's gotten to me. What happened was, after 2000, I got pretty burned out. After I finished the book, UFOs and Abductions Challenging the Borders of Knowledge, the Kansas University Press book, I'm the only person ever to publish two books with university presses that relate to UFOs and abductions. After that, and I was denied promotion again, I was very burned out and very depressed. I took about 2 years off. I mean, enough was enough, and I was very, 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 very tired, extremely tired. Because every time somebody comes to my house and we do a session, they're here all day. And as I said, I've done 1,000, and you do 1,000 of them, it gets to you after a while. I started up again in 2003, and then I began to hear things that I hadn't heard before. And, of course, once again, you just put things on the back burner. But I began to hear them from a number of people. After 2004, I began to realize that something different was happening in the abduction phenomenon. And then I began to hit it really hard, and I began to do a lot of sessions again. Not with that many people, but with enough. And then I began to realize that for the first time since I've been doing it, the phenomenon had changed.
In what way had it changed, David?
Well, in The Threat, which was not my title, which was a publisher's title and which I hated and now I've come to appreciate. In The Threat, these beings talked with abductees about how soon we were all going to be together and that soon there was going to be this change coming. And it was going to be wonderful, and everybody was going to be happy, and it was going to be just terrific, et cetera, et cetera. And I wrote in The Threat that this change, I think, is going to happen. I think that this is the goal of the program. And all the information just pointed like an arrow to it. In other words, there wasn't the information and the evidence wasn't pointing in all directions, which it should have been doing if this were psychological. It was pointing towards one sort of purpose, one sort of end. So I said, well, I don't know when this is going to happen, maybe within the next 30 years or 10, 15 years, whatever it is. And I realized that it is happening now, and more people are talking about it. And that's what my next book will be about. It will be about the change. Now, the change is the integration of human-looking hybrids into the society, if I can just say that, crazy as it sounds. And what my next book will be about is the bureaucracy and the processes about how that is being accomplished. In other words, it's not going to be a they're here, run for the hills type book. It's going to be a book describing how this is taking place, what problems there are when it takes place, how they use abductees to help them, how they do it. There's a certain bureaucratic stratas of beings who are helping to put this program into place. I want to concentrate on that and all the other problems involved with getting beings to be here.
That has to do, presumably, with the sudden pregnancies and the sudden non-pregnancies in the second trimester.
Exactly. What Bud Hopkins discovered years and years and years ago in the early 80s was the whole sort of reproductive processes that go on. The problem is, of course, is that this has been a reproductively oriented phenomenon from the beginning. Even Betty Hill mentioned that there was a needle in her navel, and she said they said it was a pregnancy test, which, of course, that was not true. This is where you have to be very, very careful. When Betty Hill said that the being told her it was a pregnancy test, without question, was not what the being said. There is no question about it that that was just not said. But we do know what the procedure is, and we do know that they never test for pregnancy. That's just not a concept. We also know that they probably wouldn't be telling her anything like that in the first place. The point is that there was this kind of reproductive aspect early on, and I think I mentioned in the thread that as early as 1972, Marjorie Fish from Ohio, who did the star map business with Betty Hill, had talked about the fact that they seemed to be interested in reproduction early, early on. And it comes out in the Antonio Villas-Boas case, of course, from 57. And it goes all the way back. It's always been with us.
Presumably, those kids who were shown to their mothers as they were taken at future times during the course of their abductions have now grown up.
Right. Well, it's a little more complicated than that. That is true. But what you have, and which is what I wrote in Secret Life, turned out to be partially true. But what you have, if you take an egg and you take sperm and you put them together, and then you alter the fertilized egg or you change it in some way, you add DNA, for example, from them, if they have DNA, and I'm just assuming so, what you're going to have is a sort of a bell-shaped curve where some are going to look alien, some are going to look human, most of them are going to look in the middle. But what I talked about in the threat was that that is correct, but in the next generation, you take an egg and you take sperm, and then you add DNA from that child or from that generation of hybrid. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't just take DNA from another alien. You take it from the hybrid. And then you get a skewed bell-shaped curve where some look quite alien, a lot look in the middle, and a bunch more look more human-like. And then you do it again and again and again, and eventually you get a spectrum where some really look very, very, very human. So, in the thread, I talked about early stage ones, which look very alien. I talked about middle stage ones, which look half and half, and I talked about late stage ones, which look human. But with changes and differences, and maybe their skin is a little off, or their eyes are too big, or something like that. But now I've added another one, which is just human stage. They're the same as us. There's several physiological and biological differences, none of which are of any serious consequence. There's only one that is of enormous consequence that cannot be emphasized enough. There's no way that I can emphasize this too much. It's not possible. And that is that all the hybrids, with varying degrees of strength, can, in fact, control humans neurologically from afar, just like aliens can. In other words, when a person is abducted, at the first few seconds of the abduction, before the beings even appear to stop their car in the night or in the daytime or whatever it is, the person is rendered passive. That rendering of passivity is already neurological control. They can't run, they can't hide, they can't grab their trusty pistol or gun or whatever it is. They can't call 911, they can't run to the neighbors, nothing like that. It's already ongoing. And then they show up, and the person is slack-jawed, and they take them aboard, they take their clothes off in a special changing room, and they look around at everybody else, and they say, gee, all those other people standing around there, sitting there, they look like zombies. They're slack-jawed, their eyes are glazed over, their muscles are not in tone. And we know that a person across the way looking at the abductee who I'm working with is looking at her or him and saying, God, that person looks like a zombie. They all look like zombies in a sense because they're just totally kind of controlled. So they can walk, but they can't run. They can hold something, use their arms, but they can't swing or grab. There's no reason to talk since all communication is telepathic. Now, having said that, every once in a while somebody will get loose and run down the hallway, and that's going to happen in 9 trillion abductions. But in general, that's all neurological control. It's all brainwave stuff. The hybrids, who are the ones who will be integrating into the society, have that ability to control humans. And I discuss this in The Threat. This turns out to be true, and this is something that makes us not just second-class citizens, but second-class beings. And the consequences of just that fact are so enormous, it is impossible to imagine all the consequences of it, none of which are good, in my opinion.
So the message, good times are coming, is probably like Betty Hill's pregnancy test.
Right, exactly. It's the message, what ain't.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe they have the milk of human kindness running by the court. Maybe they have nothing but good things in store for us. Maybe it's going to be wonderful. I can't tell the future. All I can tell is the evidence that is presented by what these beings say about the future. The future will be wonderful for them. That I can guarantee you. But for us and for non-abductees, the future is not at all certain. Let's just put it that way. It is not something that I am looking forward to. Of course, you know, at my age, I'm not looking forward to a whole huge future anyway. But I've got 2 kids, one 26 and one 20, and their future was not going to be the future that I had envisioned for them originally. That I can guarantee, and or at least I think I can guarantee it. And the point is that there are so many people out there, I think, that this is just wonderful, and these beings are here because they're so kind and humanitarian, and they're so wonderful, and it's just going to be a golden age, and there won't be any war, and there won't be any cancer, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I just hope they're right. I want that to be the case. That would make me extremely happy. That would make me feel that life is worth living, and life begins at 40, and life is beautiful, and all the rest of that stuff. Unfortunately, that's not what abductees tell me. In other words, this is not coming out of my own brain. This is coming out of evidence from abductees, as weak as it may be, that I have amassed over 21 years.
What sort of indicators are you getting, David?
Indicators in terms of what life will be like in the future?
Yeah.
Well, I can't exactly tell you that. We don't know enough about it. We do know that they keep saying everybody will know his place, that people will still have jobs, that their functions might be different, but we will not have the same kind of life. Maybe it'll be better having a master class of beings lording over us. I tend to think not.
The Earth turns into a slave colony, basically.
Well, that's one way of putting it. I don't want to be that vivid. But I would say that their concept of free will and ours are very much at odds. Their concept of order and stability is far more important to them than the ragged society that we live in, where everybody sort of does his own thing in his own time, to use a phrase out of Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm.
They have a vision of a society that is not our vision of the society. It is a society that I would not like to live in, to tell you the truth. It is ordered, but it is not one based on free will. It is based on work, function, tasks. Now, that's as far as I can go. I really don't know. They're not very forthcoming about the future. And the hybrids who talk about the future with abductees may not know themselves.
You say the hybridization program has been going on for what, 30 years?
We don't know when it started. It's a minimum of a half a century,
Mm-hmm.
And probably dating back even earlier.
the processes that the hybridization program has been through, if it's 50 years, it would seem to me that, what, we've got a bunch of 20-year-olds now who look like us and who are able to exert control over the rest of us?
It depends on function. In other words, if the function is to grow up and be, as I said in the thread, a personal project hybrid, that is to say, a companion hybrid who sort of sees the abductee over and over and over again throughout the course of the person's life, then you've got a bunch of 30, 40, 50-year-old hybrids running around performing this function. We don't see a lot of 50 and 60 and 70-year-old hybrids. I don't know why, but people do not describe them, and we should be seeing them. Either they don't live that long, or they're taken off the job and put into another place where they can live out their lives doing work, or they're jettisoned into deep space. I don't know what's going on, but we should be seeing a lot more on board who are older, and we don't. Now, hybrids have different functions depending on degree of hybridization. And the ones who are human stage have one job, and that job ultimately is to come here and sort of blend in from what abductees describe. Now, obviously, if just a couple of people said something like this, it would mean nothing. And even if a bunch of people said something like this, it would mean nothing. But in fact, I've got a tremendous number of these accounts, and it means something. But the thing is that their job is ultimately to come here. And as I said, my next book will be about, how do you do that? Okay, so you come here. Then what? How is this accomplished? How do you get an apartment? How do you buy a couch? Or whatever.
Does this tie into the Men in Black phenomena?
Well, I've never run across anything like Men in Black. Of course, it started out as sort of a hoax in the 50s. I guess Gray Barker was behind it. That it was all BS. And then people picked up on it. I realized that when you're in UFO research, you realize immediately that once a concept is thrown out into the ether or into the internet, no matter how crazy it is, and I'm going to include myself in that group, no matter how crazy it is, it never dies. It never, ever dies. There's always people around who learn about it for the first time and think it's real, no matter how nutty it is. And there's always a group of people out there who are really gullible and are really going to believe it and really think it's true and will defend it to the death. And it never dies. I think the Men in Black phenomenon is one of those phenomena that just never died. And then people picked it up as maybe relating to hybrids. And first of all, hybrids don't wear black. And we sort of know the clothing that they wear, and we also know the clothing that they wear down here to a certain extent, which is sort of normal. But there have been other oddities where people remember seeing people in black at their door and all that. And the question is, well, if they saw anything, what exactly did they see? Because this is conscious memory. And conscious memory is not to be trusted. And cases of Men in Black have not been examined by competent people yet, and it doesn't make any sense as far as we know.
The next question, Dr. David Jacobs, is, can we spot hybrids?
Now, I've had a whole bunch of people call me up and tell me that they're a hybrid. And the fact that they are telling me they are a hybrid is absolute evidence that they are not hybrids. It's absolute evidence. Because this program is based on secrecy. And once you have hybrids on the ground, security is exceptionally tight, extremely high, hysterical. Hence the book after, the one that I'm talking about now. It's absolutely hysterical. And they go into panic mode if there's the slightest attempt to figure out who these people are and why and all the rest of that stuff. So, you can't call me up and tell me you're a hybrid. It's just not going to happen. And you can't tell who is. You cannot tell who is. It wasn't very long ago, Errol, that people asking me, do you think hybrids are walking around among us right now? And the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's no question in my mind, absolutely not. And now I can't say that anymore. I have been forced into the position that I thought was a crazy position not very many years ago into saying, yes, it is possible. And it's something I never in my life ever thought I would say, but now I have to say it, unfortunately.
How are hybrids introduced into our society? Do they arrive here fully grown, or are they planted into a couple's lives as an embryo and come that way?
It's possible, but I don't have any evidence for that. I have evidence for late teen, early 20s placement primarily. But embryo or babies, now it's possible, and I just haven't talked with enough people yet, so yeah. Anything is possible. And believe me, I've been wrong about a million things in the past, and I'm going to be wrong in the future about a million things as well. But what I have seen has not matched that. I doubt it. And there's certain specific reasons why that can be doubted, because they all have a certain function, and doing their jobs and their functions are very important, and being raised by humans is not part of the function. That would be just too humanized, it seems to me. But you never know, and, you know, people claim that their children are really smart and they have a special connection to the cosmos. This is, I think, the Lake Wobegon syndrome, where every child is above average. I know if you listen to Prairie Home Companion, every family tends to think that their children are geniuses and all that. And every once in a while, the child is. I just don't place a whole lot of stock in that, mainly because I haven't found it in the research.
This conversation leaves me feeling a little uncomfortable.
I hope the future is happy, and I hope the future is wonderful. And I can't really say that it's not going to be happy and wonderful, and that would be my fondest dreams. I have no stake in an unhappy future. As I said, I've got two kids in their 20s, and I don't want them to have an unhappy future. I really want them to have a happy future, obviously. Right. But when I look at this phenomenon, I cannot derive happiness from it. People say, well, it's all hypnosis. It's your demeanor. It's what you're asking for. That's what you get. People don't know what they're saying or doing. It's easy to challenge hypnosis. It's always more difficult to answer it. And anybody can challenge the problems of hypnosis who doesn't know anything about hypnosis. You just say it. And then the people who do hypnosis have to deal with that. What I used to do is that I would tell people, okay, now, this time, what you just told me sounds to me like a dream. This really sounds like a dream. This is a dream. Then I would do an induction, and we do the hypnosis to see how that affected them. And, of course, it doesn't affect them whatsoever. They couldn't care less what I said it was. All they know is they remember it happened to them. I would tell people now, I don't want you to tell me anything upsetting. I don't want to hear anything bad. I only want to hear good things. Just tell me good things. I don't want to hear anything bad. Nothing bad. This is a direct command. Then I would do hypnosis. And, of course, once again, they couldn't care less what this idiot sitting next to them was saying to them. All they know is what happened to them. There was no way I could influence them or anything like that. Having said that, you know, with the problems of hypnosis, people do say things that are not true. They say, you know, here's the problem. The problem is this, that all communication is telepathic with aliens. With hybrids, it's all telepathic, too, on board an object, but here it can be either. If all communication is telepathic, you ask people what it is that they mean by telepathy, they'll say, well, I receive an impression in my mind that converts it to words, and I know that I have to get my clothes off, or I know I have to get up on the table, and all the rest of that stuff. Well, the question then is, what is to prevent them from hearing their own thoughts, assuming that they're coming from the outside, and assuming that they're coming from aliens? And the answer is, nothing is to prevent that. It happens all the time. It's a huge area of confabulation. And if you take at face value what everybody says right away, you're making a fatal error. Consequently, you have to be very, very, very careful. The thing is that with hypnosis, most people are aware of the problems of hypnosis. When they come to me, they're aware that they're going to be suggestible, they're going to be vulnerable, they're aware that they can be led, they're aware that they're coming to an abduction researcher. I mean, and, you know, people who complain about that are correct, obviously. But the point is that the abductees are aware of that. They don't want to pick up things in popular culture, which they're aware of as well, and parrot them back to me. They don't want me to influence them. They're on top of that. They understand it. it's other things that they don't understand that a professional will understand. They will understand the problems of telepathy and how that can get into their mind as alien discussion with them and that sort of thing. And that's a big red flag area of you've got to be very, very careful. But if you know what you're doing, you can control for all that. You can account for it. So the evidence that I've been gaining with all my controls and all the rest of that stuff has been the change is here. We are in the change now. Now, this doesn't mean that every single abductee is involved with the change. It means that a lot of them are, and most of them aren't, probably. It's not a question of everybody is now saying the same thing. It's a question of there are a number of abductees who are, in fact, now saying things that they have never told me before, ever. And they don't know others are saying it, although they do, of course, now. And it all started to happen at once, starting around 2003 or so, when the first guy who I'd never met before came to my house. He was a referral from a psychiatrist, in fact. And he started talking about this friend he had who accompanied him here, there, and everywhere, and all the discussions they had about relationships and discussions about this and discussions about that. And I'd never heard anything like that before. I'd heard sort of stuff about personal project hybrids, but this is a different thing. This was a learning situation about learning how to live here. And I had never heard that before, not in this kind of detail, not with a person of this caliber who was one of the most intelligent and highly placed individuals that I've ever worked with. I didn't know what to think of it. I didn't have any other accounts like this. And I actually gave a talk about this to Bud Hopkins Intruder Seminar several years back and just threw it open to the audience saying, you tell me. Since that time, I've had a lot more confirmation.
Are you seeing manifestations of being told what would happen? Are you seeing that going down around you now, outside of the abductees?
I can't tell. All I know is that people are talking about helping them move in, helping them do this, helping them do that, teaching them this, teaching them that. And I know that if I've been working with let's just say 7 or 8 individuals who have talked about this, then there's got to be 70 or 80 million of them out there. I haven't stumbled into something with people who live within 100 miles of me that is not happening anywhere else. That's just not possible. Every single thing that I've ever learned seems to be happening everywhere, and I think that that's true with this as well. There's no reason to say that this is different. This is not different. This is just part of what they've been talking about for years and years and years and years. Mm. This is something that the aliens and the hybrids have been talking about. This great, glorious, wonderful change that's going to happen. And now it's happening. In other words, there's no great leap here. It's a natural progression that they have alerted us to. And in my opinion, this is happening now. And I could never say that before. And I know how crazy it makes me sound. And I know I don't have the evidence to back it up because I don't have a book behind me yet. But when you read the book, I hope, if I can write it correctly, that you will understand right away that the evidence for this is a lot stronger than you could ever imagine.
There have been seemingly way less abductions, or at least reports of abductions, over the last few years. Have you noticed a decline, or is the reluctance to come forward on the part of abductees part of the plan?
Yeah, you've hit on something here. In my opinion, abductions have gone up dramatically. Not the number of people abducted. That's going to stay constant. It is the frequency of abductions. And whereas people might have been abducted maybe a couple of times a month or something like that, now I have a number of people who are being abducted almost daily. I've had that for short bursts of time in the past, and people have ridiculed me for even talking about that. But now it's happening a lot more to a lot more people. So I think that the frequency, and I've asked people who have seen me for a number of years, I always ask them, do you think it's going up or down? And invariably, in the last couple of years, it's been up. But the question is, are more people coming forward? Well, for me, in terms of my email, it's pretty much the same. I'm getting the same number of questionnaires from my website, and I'm getting the same number of people writing to me saying this has happened to them as I ever did. That's probably because there's the same number of people out there who have been abducted. Actually, it's growing with the population, so I should be getting more. But, however, once this program is in place, the change, then security goes sky high, and then any discussion of it, any talking about it, is considered betrayal and non-compliance with the program, and punishments can be severe. And consequently, I have a feeling that once people start dealing with the change and are cogs in the wheel of the change, that they may not come forward then, because they have been instructed to, in no uncertain terms, not to do that. And I can easily see this affecting the number of adoptees who would come forward. But I don't really know, of course. I'm just sort of conjecturing myself. But the fact is, though, that as far as I know, everything is pretty much the same. If I want, I could be doing a million sessions a day. To me, it's a matter of, it's an overwhelming phenomenon. I don't see any significant change.
Are you yourself an abductee?
No, I'm not an abductee. And I would have known it early on and been involved with this subject every day of my life since 1965, and in the abductions every day of my life since 1982, when I first started getting interested in it with Bud Hopkins. I would know. And the answer is no, I am not, and neither was my mother or my father, and neither are my children. And because this is, you know, is an intergenerational phenomenon, and if you have kids, you'd be a middle person, so to speak.
Yes, yes. I often describe the work that I do around the field rather than in the field. The work that I do around the field as being my assignment, whether I choose to accept it or not. Do you get a sense of that yourself?
Well, no. I get a sense more that I've just sort of got interested in a subject and I kind of fell into it, and I threw caution to the wind and I just bullheadedly pushed forward with it. And it became my pursuit in life to try to solve the mystery, if I possibly can, mystery of UFOs. And I've done it to my satisfaction, probably not to anybody else's satisfaction, to a large extent. If I had to do it all over again, I think I would stay the hell away from it.
Yes.
I would have gone for a normal life.
I found that the number of times I've said, that's it, I quit, I don't want to do this anymore, that feeling lasts a couple of 3 days, and then I'm dragged back into it again.
And there you go. You see, you have to remember that the subject is intrinsically interesting. Now, here's my opinion, and here's where I start making enemies. I think, in my own thought processes, by the mid to late 1970s, we knew pretty much everything there was to know about sightings. And what you're talking about in terms of sightings is the sightings of the outside shells of objects. There have been books written about car stoppages and UFOs, and UFOs' effects on the environment, and UFOs' effects on animals, and UFOs' effects on people, and studies done about how many people of the priest, the minister, and the rabbi were there, and they all saw it, and they could triangulate it, and it was in the air for X number of minutes. Studies done on the color changes and maneuvers and all that sort of stuff. By the late 70s, I think that the phenomenon of sighting analysis was pretty much exhausted. And we, God knows how many sightings we had, and people had stashed away in their drawers, probably millions. And there was this big cataloging, and there was going to be a computerization and all the rest of that stuff. And you're dealing with hundreds of thousands at that point. And the question is, if you do sightings and you keep adding sightings of objects to the mountain of sightings that we already have, are we going to advance knowledge of the phenomenon appreciably? And the answer is not really. What it does is it simply adds to the validation of the phenomenon. Yes, something truly odd was there. It was metallic. It had unusual maneuvers. It did this. It did that. It came within 500 feet or landed on the ground, and we could measure the, you know, the marks on the ground and all that. And it validates the idea that the phenomenon was indeed there and it was truly anomalous. But it does not tell you anything about the people inside and the motivations and goals and purposes of why they're there. And, of course, a million different theories evolved over the years from the late 40s on, really, about why they're here, why they're not landing on the White House lawn, why they're doing this and why they're doing that. The only thing that's really given us any insight into the phenomenon has been the abduction scenario. And once we started looking at abductions, then you begin to understand why they're not landing on a White House lawn and why they're being secretive and all that. But the problem is that most people can't do abduction research. It's enormously time-consuming. There is a learning curve that is much steeper than doing sighting research. You're delving into very, very personal aspects of people's lives. So you can't be a 19-year-old doing abduction hypnosis on a 42-year-old woman. It's just not going to happen. You know what I mean? They won't. Mm-hmm. They're not going to say anything. But you can be a 19-year-old doing sighting research. And so I think that what happened is when people couldn't do abduction research, you begin to get all these debates about whether abductions are real or not real, and you get a whole lot of really incompetent people who go into it and who have these new age and religious agendas and all that, and things get sort of splayed all over the place. And then people just sort of naturally turn to, rather than sighting analysis, and they can't do abduction research because it's so hard, is you turn to doing research into government conspiracy theories, or you turn to older sightings and start rehashing battles over older sightings and all that. Mm. In my opinion, and this is just me, this is where people get angry at me, I think it's important to do all that, and I think that it's important to keep the issue alive, and I commend people who do that. But at the same time, our knowledge has not advanced a whole heck of a lot about the phenomenon itself, in other words. And I think that a lot of people have just gotten away from doing studies and research into the phenomenon itself. And it's not their fault because, as I said, by the 70s, we pretty much knew it. I used to try to get people to do abduction research, and a lot of people have dropped out, and people don't do it anymore. And it's so hard to do, and some of the people who I really like don't do it anymore, and there's no young crop of people coming up, and I tried to get others interested in it, they just stay the hell away from it. And it's a losing proposition. It's just losing, losing, losing. I have graduate students who are interested in the abduction or UFO phenomenon, and they want to do some sort of research in it for their dissertation, and I tell them, are you crazy? What's wrong with you? Because if they were to write a dissertation about UFOs and in any way, shape, or form find that there might be something to it, they will never get a job in the academic world as long as they live, period. If they were to write a dissertation that says there's nothing to it, it's just a pile of crap, they will never get a job in the academic world, period. Because everybody knows that. Why would they even write a dissertation like that? What are they doing? Reinventing the wheel? What kind of judgment does this person have? So I just tell them, go into another field of interest, get tenure, and then you can start doing research in it. And believe me, the amount of takers on that area are, so far, pretty much zero.
Well, you're absolutely right about the number of people that are leaving the field of late.
Yeah.
And a number of people who were tremendously useful to the field over the years. And when you talk about the number of academics interested in abductions, in UFOs, more academics have fled than have come and joined.
I agree with you 100% and even more so. Here's the situation. Having been involved in this subject for as long as I've been in it, which is not as long as Richard Hall has, for example, but in terms of the academics of it all, it's longer probably than most. Maybe Ron Westrum and I would probably be the longest in terms of academics in it. I have never seen the academic community reacting the way it does towards the subject now. Before, most academics said, well, I don't know, you know, we have to look at the evidence, and the evidence isn't in, et cetera, et cetera. And they would take sort of a neutral and maybe even patronizing stance and all that. And that's sort of to be expected. Now, it's not just that they're neutral or they'll mouth platitudes or something like that. Those are the good old days. Now they're aggressively hostile to it. I have never seen anything like it in all the years that I've been involved in this subject. I've never seen such a lack of interest and such hostility to the subject as right now by so-called academics. And I just don't know how to stem the tide of that. When I put together the edited book, which has some very, very good people in it, Michael Swords and Jerry Clark and Bud Hopkins and John Mack and Michael Persinger and Eddie Bullard and a lot of really good people, although Persinger, of course, is more of a debunker than anything, Stuart Appel, of course, John Dondery, all these people are what I consider to be really serious thinkers about this subject. And we aimed it at the academic community. We wanted to show the academic community that there was a there, that serious research and serious thought was piling up about this subject. I had a long bibliography in the back of it, an enormously long bibliography for this kind of a book. It was done very, very carefully, and it took me a year just to get my proposal agreed to by the University Press of Kansas board. And we thought we would make a difference by showing them that this is indeed an academic subject. And the effect has been, I would say, probably a little bit less than zero. Just nothing. There's been no response from any academics at all about the subject. And nobody has written to me and saying, you know, this book has really changed my mind about it. I always thought this was a pile of crap, but, you know, I read that book and it got me to think, not even once.
And what sort of sales did the book garner to university libraries?
It did sell to university libraries, although the library system is not what it used to be in terms of buying academic books automatically. But they've done okay in their sales. They've done okay. I'm not privy to all of them, but they've done all right. And I think they're now finally selling out their hardcover edition. And so, I don't know, maybe they sold 5,000 books or something like that, which for an academic press is a big book.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not big enough for a trade press, but for an academic press, they're nonprofit presses, so it's good for them. But the point is that they are selling to the academic community. They're advertising academic pamphlets and in the proceedings of various conferences and that sort of stuff. Anyway, the point is that we know a lot of people have read it. It didn't do what it was supposed to do, and it's very frustrating, extremely frustrating. And, of course, the subject itself is obviously, on the surface, crazy. A lot of people are very interested in the government's role in this. And I think that the government situation and people's concern with it has helped to make academics hostile, because you're sort of asking them that to believe that UFOs are real and that the government knows about it and that the government has been covering up. These are sort of blocks to believability. And I think the abduction phenomenon has done the same thing. You're asking them to believe that UFOs are real, they're from outer space or whatever, and that the government knows about it, and the government has been covering up, and people are being abducted by it, and the only time they can remember it is through hypnosis, and it's really happening. And academics just aren't going to go there. They're just not going to do that. It's just not going to happen. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I'm complicit in this, I think.
In the same way that they have evolved a lot of coffee and keyboard ufologists out there over the years, and I'm complicit in that with the UFO updates list, and quite possibly with the program I've been doing for 9 years now. On the one hand, I'm glad to be of service, and on the other, I often ask myself, well, what good have you done, and has it been worth it?
That's the same thoughts that go through my brain. Not about you, but about my own work. I mean, has it been worth it? So, okay, I've written a couple of books, and I've got another one that I hope I can get published if my agent agrees to it. And the question is, will I be doing any good, or will I just be stroking my own ego?
My ego got tired of this a long time ago.
Right. Well, that's the way I feel about it, too. I think that I've been at this for so long, and I'm pretty tired again. And the thought of going on a book tour and talking about how aliens are walking among us does not thrill me with delight.
And then you'll get the Larry Kings who'll bring on the Michael Shermers of the so-called Committee for the So-Called Investigation of
Things
of the Paranormal.
Right, yeah. The, quote, voices of reason.
Yes, yes.
It's so easy to be a debunker, as Alan Hendry is the one who said. All you have to do is just say a person is lying or a person is mistaken, and that's what it boils down to. And then you just make that claim. You just keep making it over and over and over again, and the person who's making the claim in some way has to deal with it. It's the easiest thing in the world to be a debunker. And all these debunkers take the easy way out. Because, you know, of course, I'm not saying that they're disingenuous. They really do think that there is nothing to it. But in my humble opinion, Errol, all debunkers, all of them, have one or more of three things in common. Either they do not know the evidence, they distort the evidence, or they ignore the evidence. All of them, I have found no exceptions to that, all of them have that in common. Distortion of the evidence you see quite often with older cases. Oh, well, a person didn't see this, they saw that. So they'll take the evidence as is agreed upon by everybody and then distort it to conform to their own explanations. And this whole pelican theory, you know, is a perfect example of something like that. It's taking the evidence, ignoring it, and saying, no, they saw something else, a distortion of it. All debunkers do that. I have not found anybody who is really resistant to that impulse. I have a review of Susan Clancy's book, Abducted, on my website. It's on the front page right now, which is getting to be outmoded because the book is fading into the background. Her attempts to solve the abduction mystery are so pathetic and so academically dishonest, if I may even say that. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but there are certain things about it that I thought were really not kosher, shall we say. You wonder how it is that a book like that could ever be published by Harvard University Press. Now, just because you graduated from Harvard doesn't mean that Harvard's going to publish your book, and that happens all the time. In fact, most of the time. The question then is, how could that be published? Well, when you look at the book, there are all sorts of horrendous factual errors in it. Factual errors, not errors in interpretation. We'll grant her interpretation, but factual errors. And the answer is that the academic community doesn't particularly care. Rather than sending the manuscript for refereeing, and all academic press books are refereed, as far as I know, that for referring to either Bud Hopkins or to Jerry Clark or to me or to somebody else who knows something about the field, or Michael Swords, or somebody who's in academics and knows something about the field for review, they just send it to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or whoever it is that they sent it to, it who said, oh, this is just wonderful and this is fine, and then Harvard winds up, I'm the only second book about UFOs or abductions that they ever published, and the book is filled with factual errors, gross misinterpretations, things that are said that are so off the wall your jaw falls open, and it's just typical debunking stuff, only with a glaze of dripping condescension in it. And here's Harvard publishing it. And you just think to yourself, you know, I should have become a salesman at Walmart.
I guess, in a way, it's a nya, 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 nya to Dr. John Mack.
Yeah, well, she had a thing for John because John was at Harvard. That's what she talked about. There's no evidence that she actually read anything other than a little bit of John Mack. But for debunkers, having facts right, doing things correctly, being sure of your evidence is not a concept when it comes to abductions or UFOs. Years ago, and this is typical, Carl Sagan wrote an article for Parade magazine in preparation for his book, The Demon-Haunted World. The article itself would be read by many, many, many more people who would ever read his book, because it's a Sunday insert. Parade magazine is a Sunday insert in newspapers across the country in the United States. And so millions of people get it. In this article, I got a hold of the manuscript, and I found factual errors, errors of fact. Once again, I didn't go into his interpretation, which had to do with folklore and hallucination and stuff that he had no knowledge of or anything like that. But I found errors in fact about Barney and Betty Hill and this and that, and I researched them to make sure that they were in fact errors, which they were, and sent them all back. And when the article came out, only one minor change had been made. Just one minor change. The change was that Betty and Barney said that the aliens slithered when they walked, and they didn't actually say that. So that word was taken out. The other errors, in fact, remained in. And the answer is, it doesn't matter to debunkers. They don't care whether they get their facts right or wrong. That is of no concern. In the end, they're going to be right, according to their own egos. In the end, they're going to be right. UFOs can't exist, and people are not being abducted. It doesn't matter how you get there. It doesn't matter if you're academically honest or not. You're going to be right. So why bother to have to take the energy to go back and look at your stuff and make sure that you got the facts right? That's what I find in the academic world.
It seems to be prevalent everywhere. It's a condition of the society that we live in nowadays.
It is, and it's not very encouraging, and I'm just not dancing for joy for the future and all that.
Yeah. In addition to everything else that you've learned of late.
In addition to everything else, and as I said, the thought of me going on a book tour to try to sell a book that talks about things that people in the UFO and abduction community think are absolutely insane does not fill me with delight, and it's something that I... that I really don't look forward to, but I'm going to publish this book no matter what, because I've got this and then this other little book I'm going to do afterwards, and that might be it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably be around 70 at that time, and that might be it for me. Maybe I'll just spend the rest of my days watching TV. That's something that I look forward to.
Well, I'm probably around the same age that you are. I'm coming up for 65. There's a pension coming up the month after my birthday, and we'll see what happens then.
Yeah, my birthday's in August. I'll be 65, and I have to wait for 10 months to get Social Security after that.
You mentioned your website, David Jacobs. Would you give it to the listener, please?
Yes, it's www.ufoabduction.com. One word, UFO abduction, no S.
As I've said to you in the past, I admire your work greatly. I admire you greatly. I'm amazed that you stuck it out as long as you have, that you have managed to maintain all this time. And I look forward to both of your new books.
Well, thanks, Errol. I appreciate it. And I think you should keep up the good work with UFO updates. I enjoy looking at them, and I read certain people. The ones I don't read, of course, I think everybody does that. And the point is that it keeps the debate alive. There isn't any other place where there is sort of an international debate about the subject.
Well, there are a couple of closed email lists, Jan Aldrich's and Francis Ridge's, but they're, you know, those are by invitation only. They don't publicly archive, which is a great shame.
If it's not publicly archived, and if it's only by invitation, it has its strengths and it has its weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And the great weakness is that it does not disseminate information to all who want it.
David Jacobs, thank you, sir. The time has flown by.
Well, you're not here to wrestle me to the ground to get me to stop talking. That was the problem.
I've enjoyed it immensely. As I said earlier, I'm not sure I'm totally thrilled by what it is that you've had to say, but it needs to be said, and the potential for what you have said happening, and you haven't been explicit yet, is enormous. It would seem to me if they bothered to do what they've been doing for all of these years, if not centuries, something is afoot.
Right, exactly. Something is afoot. And I agree with you about what you said about not wanting to hear what I have to say. I don't want to hear it either.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this, that there's basically, for the next book, there'll be 10 more years of research into it, and for my life, it does have meaning, so even though I don't like what the meaning is.
Well, I've been saying for years, I really want to know what's going on, but I may not like the answer.
Right, exactly.
Thank you, David Jacobs.
Thanks, Errol. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And somewhat worrisome SDI this time, don't you think? Might I suggest that you visit David Jacobs' website and spend some time there? That's at ufoabduction.com. And also at John Velez's Abduction Information Center, which is off the front page at virtuallystrange.net. You really do need to look into the various things we discuss here on this program. There is much strangeness going on that several someones somewhere know about and aren't sharing with the people that pay their salaries. That would be you. My thanks to Dave Frelott, Stuart Miller, and Dr. David Jacobs for getting our attention, and to you for helping to make this program possible. Until the next time.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.